We're back with a better connection. Thank you for your patience. This was not a test.
Hello.
So I think we'll start tonight with just a brief period of maybe 2 or 3 minutes of silent meditation, not more, before delving in, just to create a space for us. I'll ask everyone to find a comfortable seat. Don't have to be too particular about it. And feel your feet on the floor. Notice the temperature of the air against any exposed skin. Does it feel cool or warm? Anything attached to that? And perhaps gently closing your eyes. Turning into your breath. With some curiosity, what can your breath tell you about how you're doing in this moment? Is it strained or easy? Even or uneven? Resting attention with the breath for a little bit. Whenever your attention goes elsewhere, to thought or sound, feeling, just notice where you've gone. Notice that moment where you realize you've gone somewhere. And gently come back to your breath. As often as you need. Taking as much or as little time as you want, opening your eyes. I wanted to just open with a sort of closing on a bar. We'll have maybe a moment if anyone wants to share anything. Maybe there'll be a lot. Maybe there won't be a lot. I don't know. And then we'll jump right in. So it was just Parshat Noach, and there's a comment of Rashi that Noach was Miketani Amana. He was of little faith, not so faithful. And Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev always views people charitably. It's an incredible strength. I've mentioned this teaching every year for many years now. So if it feels repetitive, I mentioned it last Shabbat and then last year on Parshat Noach and the year book every single year for 9 years in a row. But I love it. So he wants to judge Noach charitably. What does it mean he was of little faith? So he says, "V'ha'elo emuna ba'atzmo." He didn't have faith in himself. Shehu tzadik moshel v'yachol levatel ha'gzeirah. That he is righteous, a ruler, and he can cancel God's decrees. God wants there to be a flood, but he could say no. He doesn't have to accept it. After all, there's the model of Avraham, who when God says, destroy, Avraham says, but wait, every time. So, Adarabba haya chashuv meinav kishar ador. He thought he was just like everyone else. Haya choshev im ani ahiya nitzol. But if I would be saved in an ark, and I'm no more righteous than anyone else alive, then it must be that God has prophesied to everyone, you'll be saved, you'll be saved, you'll be saved. Make an ark, make an ark. I can't be the only person that received this vision. Make an ark. Everyone must have, because I'm no better than anyone else. So I thought that this source is interesting in the context of Anava, because here it's viewed as a charitable read on Noah. He was like humble in a colloquial sense of the term. He didn't think he was so special. And actually the source of his limited faith, which is ostensibly a negative comment, is reread here as a kind of positive. He didn't think that he was of particular talent. But as a result, he's faulted for that. And so this sort of fits into those sources about sort of counteracting the classic view of humility, not the Musar classic view, but the classic view out there, that humility is about not thinking you're better than anyone else, as opposed to an accurate assessment of everyone's unique talents and flaws. And Noah had particular talents, but he underestimated them. I'll leave it at that. Sort of common, I think, is related to our subject of humility, in a sense that humility could actually mean not doing the Noach and saying, I'm just like everyone else. But it could have been that he would go and say, actually, I'm more righteous than the rest of you. You're all going to drown in a flood. Save yourselves. Repent. That would have been better. Did anyone have any reflections on the teaching, on personal practice? One of the things I'm going to note, and we'll try and keep prodding it a little, is that it takes some time in a group setting for people to reflect personally. And so I had the benefit of listening to the recording of last time's session. I noticed that every single time there was a personal question, like how do you in your life deal with this? Everyone externalized implicitly. Everyone was like, well, I think some people do this or don't, I've seen people do that, but no one really in the recording like talked about themselves. And that might be, so I was aware of that. And so perhaps, it takes some time to sit with the idea before you can really apply it. It could be that's just it. Or it could be that people don't quite feel cozy enough yet with each other. And so people are scouting out, is it safe to share personal details about my character flaws? So if you are in that boat, I just want to encourage people that this is, I hope, a safe group. I happen to know every one of you. I like you all. I wouldn't have just said that. I would have said nothing if it weren't true. And I believe it is a good faith group that holds everyone in esteem and wants the success of each individual. And so I want to encourage people, as questions get sort of personal sometimes, to be willing to consider not just how do I play with this Jewish idea, but how does it manifest in my life? Because that's the point of Musar, is to have, as the Rav Yisrael Salanter said, to have the heart. The mind, the heart, what was the quote? To have the heart know what the mind, to do what you know, right? The point is here is more like behavioral, we're in the behavioral realm or the psychological realm, a little more than the ivory tower or the academic. So I open up any final comments, reflections on humility, on the practice. Were you able to even do the practice? holidays are now more over. I was going to send reminders out in a Google group, and then midway through doing that, I realized no one signed up to the Google group. I don't know if people even got those invitations.
No, I couldn't. I wrote back to you, but I couldn't.
Okay, my failure. I'm going to not use the Google group. I don't know how to use it. If someone knows how to set up a Google group, help me. Otherwise, I'm just going to send a BCC email with maybe not daily reminders, but occasional reminders, teachings, things that are appearing in my life that relate as a reminder. Comments on humility. Yes.
I had a discussion with my son about it. Apparently somebody told him he did really good on something and laughed. And I said, "Why are you laughing?" And he said, "Because I don't know how to accept praise." He was really embarrassed by it. So we talked about it and we discussed that, you know, it's okay to be praised and he should be proud of that. Even if he doesn't think it's important or he doesn't feel that he deserves it, he should still, you know, be nice about it and say thank you and appreciate it. And so that was kind of a way to discuss it and kind of bring it home a little bit. So he now understands a little bit that he shouldn't giggle about it. I mean, he's a teenager, but you know, he shouldn't be embarrassed by it. He should be proud of it. Even if he doesn't feel worthy of it, it's still somebody is proud of him. He should appreciate that.
I could say something in support of that. We read that there's like the spectrum from arrogance to self-deprecation.
Can you hear it all?
You didn't use that term, self-deprecation. But, so that and that sort of connects to the story. It's a whole lot in the middle.
Yeah.
I guess that was the hope that we sort of internalize and see, well, where do we fall? They had some good questions. How are you doing? Answer every question. You know, so. Do you want anything? I wasn't expecting to see that. Self-deprecation
is all the way on it. I wonder if we think that what if somebody took credit for our genes? Of course, it's, so you know, it's one thing to acknowledge one's strengths, another thing to say, it's me. Thank God. In a way, where does it come from? And so, you know, two people acknowledge strengths, but it's very different depending on where one acknowledges the source of the strengths.
I'm thinking of the Talmudic story, I'm forgetting the name of the Amora of the sage, but he comes and he insults another Amora, is a famous story, for being very ugly. People know this story. For being hideous. He says, "You're hideous. Get out of here," basically. I forget exact details. And he basically says, "Why don't you go complain to my maker?" So that's the other side of the same coin, certain sense, right? Which is, as we think about what we've been given, to think about it as either what we've been given or maybe what we've cultivated, right? Sometimes we cultivate a particular, like this thing. We're doing active work to try and improve our character. And so there's some sense of, I did it, but the very character we're trying to cultivate acknowledges the ecosystem that exists in the supportive environment or God who enables it at each moment, which is actually a perfect segue, unless anyone has anyone else they want to share, to Sablanut. And why is it a perfect segue? I actually wasn't intending to make the segue. It was just the perfect segue. It's not a gimmick. Why? So that's what we're up to, right? So this is based on an idea from Rabbi Moshe Cordovero. People may know Rabbi Moshe Cordovero, known as the Ramak. I throw these things out because it's always good to create empowered Jewish learners. Empowered Jewish learners are able to place in context, the sources in historical context, in ideological context, in hashkafic context, and in order to be able to learn on our own a little bit as well. And so I throw out like biographical and other details in that hope that they begin to place schools of thought in people. Rabbi Moshe Cordovero was an early Kabbalist in Tzfat before the Ari, just before and coexistent with. And his system of Kabbalah was the dominant system of Jewish mysticism before the Ari came and had this sort of dramatic revelation of a slightly different kind of Kabbalah. And he wrote a book called Tomer Devorah, The Palm Tree of Deborah, in the Veltheim Torah Classics Library. It's a worthwhile read, especially by holiday season. But one of the things he notes in our relationship to understanding God's forgiveness of us, if we think about that, is the idea of sablanut, that God tolerates our sins. That's the first step to forgiveness. And what does it mean to tolerate sin? So in that case, it means to keep you alive as you're sinning. It's a very tough idea of tolerance, right? Because if God is the source of our life and we're rebelling, he's not just hoping for our forgiveness, but he's actually infusing us with life energy to commit the sin. He's helping the sin in a certain way in the hope that we might repent. So that's a very extreme version of tolerance. I would think it would be unhealthy in a relationship. One would aid someone in hurting them in the hopes that they might come to a realization. Hey, but God can do that. But so it's a good draw, sort of recognizing the extent to which it's not us, because sablanut will be largely based on a non-egoistic understanding of life, which has to sort of, we have to sort of forgo certain things of our character in order to be patient, you know, like immediate gratification or what we want. Sort of basic of that is, you want this, you'll have to wait. You may not get it. That's a sort of limiting of the self, but it doesn't have to be framed as negative. It could be an acknowledgement framed in the positive of, I exist not only as an individual, also as an individual, but also as a creation of God and as a member of a people and a family and a community and many other things. Marcia, do you have a comment?
No, sorry.
No, it's okay. Okay, end of my disorganized comments on sablanut. Let us jump in. Before I bias us further and we read more, when you think about sablanut, usually translated as patience, what comes to mind?
Everything.
Yeah.
You know, whatever you do, we usually take some patience. Most things are not automatic. Right now, it's not the temperature, but it's automatic. Cooking something, you've got to wait for it to cook, from raising children and being patient with that process. Everything, I think, just requires a lot of patience. Mm-hmm. Understanding where people are.
So I will say collectively, this is not a bad midah as a society to be working on. And I'll speak for myself as one of the original rules of the thought and say, I have a harder time with patience due to the immediacy of so many things in my life that weren't immediate just a few decades ago or whatever it was. I think back to when the internet first came out and it took like 25 minutes just to get a free dial tone line to get on, and each website could take an hour to load. I don't remember those days, or before the internet, where you might call someone and they weren't home and you couldn't get them on a cell phone. Maybe people started to have pagers when I was young, but like you'd have to wait until and if they returned your call. It was a very different time. I struggle much more with patience because people expect me to respond immediately. There seems to be frustration if I'm not doing things quickly. And I respond in kind, I think, to some large or small extent. Anyone else? Is sharing? patience.
I mean, the first thing that I think of is my totally irritating evening with my four-year-old daughter and how impatient I was. And I really love the definition of here. I was actually thinking I want to put it on my bathroom mirror, that it's the quality of bearing discomfort to sustain connection to oneself, others, and God. I feel like that something about patience, I guess when I think about it that way, has to do with keeping my mind on, like, I feel like impatience in some ways, to go back to humility, is sort of like, it comes from like overinflating the things that are on my mind that I have to do. Like, oh, I have to get to this class, so I have to do this other thing, and so I really need her to brush her teeth right now. But that's sort of inflating my sense of importance. And if I really think about what is more cosmically important, my relationship to her, I mean, I'm focusing on it so much just because I think it's a good example, not because it was that terrible and she's asleep right now. but I'm aware of times when I lose track of that connection, and instead I'm focusing on something else as if it were so important, and really it isn't. Because I think it's like more than just waiting. It's waiting while thinking about the true thing.
Yeah.
I kind of decided about 6 months ago that I was just done worrying and being stressed about things that I just really couldn't control, and decided that I just didn't have the energy anymore. There was too much going on in my life, and there were too many things that I was just like, I was done. And so I decided that, you know what, if it's out of my control, I'm not gonna worry about it. If it's not like directly affecting me, and I think I've become much calmer and happier since I started invoking that process. Mm-hmm. So I'm not like stressing over, you know, so the whole patience, like, I don't worry about things that just, whatever, it is what it is, and I can't do anything about it, so I'm not gonna stress over it. So the whole idea of patience is, I don't even need it because I'm not even going to worry about it. So It's really helped me.
So these are interesting comments, because they point to patience as it relates to our sort of desire to implicitly kind of want to control other people or things that are beyond our control in order to like facilitate our ideas going in a particular way. And inevitably.
I'd say one place I think I'm not patient is being misunderstood. I don't know what that, I mean, it's, I think it's a similar space, but initially I was thinking it's like more about like not being like present with like what's happening in front of you, but wanting things to be different. That's like one, but that feels like more abstract than like when I really lose my patience is really because I'm like, why don't you understand what I'm saying? I don't, or give me what I need, or I don't know. It's like, but even getting what you need is different than like just being like understood. I don't know, it's weird. I feel like that's it. Being misunderstood is a hard place to be in a patient.
One of the original legal excuses for defensive murder in the United States legal system was being falsely arrested, interestingly, like it's an interesting exception, but like arrested, but you didn't do it, but they got you and you react violently, so you're not allowed to like kill the police officer, but they would drop the capital punishment in that case against you. They would reduce it to a jail sentence as opposed to a death penalty in the original law. And the thought was that there's nothing like being falsely, there's nothing so bad as being falsely accused was the sentiment, which might, again, an extreme version, but related, right, to be sort of accused of something you haven't done. But it's ultimately about patience in a certain sense, or there you might be afraid you're going to get hung.
Misunderstood. But then you need to have the patience to get out of jail until everything gets washed away.
I wonder if the impatience is what we think about for myself, and I feel like the impatience with others and that understanding is a little easier than the of myself saying, get your act together and figure out how to articulate better so that it's not your fault. They're not accurate. It's fault. I'm not going to be more articulate. So some of the things I feel like are sort of psychological projections and turn around being sort of patient with ourselves, forgiving ourselves. There's enough stuff on Chagim, you know, we think about forgiveness and things. All this, you know, forgiving, and we say it's hard to be forgiving ourselves. Hard to be hard on ourselves. Maybe it's easy, but actually, it's easy for me to be hard on myself. Sometimes to be patient, back off of myself. I always want to be smarter. I wish I had another 15, 20 points IQ. You know, 50 words, 100 words of vocabulary. Yeah. Something feels like it's within reach. It's not like it's, you know, it's like
possible. So we'll jump into the introductory essay together. It's on page 71. A volunteer to read.
You can do that.
Okay.
Savlanut, forbearance, patience. Savlanut, or the ability to bear emotional discomfort, is a key mida for all spiritual and emotional growth, not to mention living with others and achieving success in work. While this term is often translated as patience, I think forbearance is a better description of this midah. The Hebrew root samath vav lamed means to bear or suffer. Rav Wolbe uses the image of carrying a load to describe savlanut. Each relationship we have comes with a certain load we need to carry if we are to stay in the relationship. None of us are perfect. We all have baggage. We need savlanut to deal with our own baggage and that of our children, partners, parents, and friends. Want me to keep going?
Sure.
Savlanut involves becoming more aware, moment to moment, of the load we are holding and continue to bear the load and its accompanying emotions without casting them off or rejecting them. Savlanut does not mean shutting down or repressing feelings, nor does it mean being passive or accepting perceived injustice without response. Savlanut calls on us to respond to unpleasant experiences, be they annoyances, insults, and/or injustices, while maintaining our relationship with ourselves and/or with others who challenge us. Extending the metaphor of carrying, if the burden feels too heavy, we may need to get some help carrying it rather than just throw it off. Dr. Alan Morinus uses the metaphor of a lit match and a fuse. We practice savlanut by extending the distance between the match and the fuse.
So one interesting patience practice, it's getting a little colder. I don't know, everyone's a hardy New Englander here. So it's actually a good practice. There are all kinds of things we tend to do physically when it's colder out, job or think warm thoughts or other things. But if you find yourself walking and it's getting colder until it seems snow Friday morning, one interesting practice that I heard from Rabbi Jaffe, who wrote the curriculum, was to briefly embrace the cold. Not necessarily as pleasant, although maybe, but just to like stop trying to not think about the cold or and just, okay, it's cold. What does it feel like that it's cold? As a patience practice, actually. Patience, savlanut, as a, like, I'm facing the cold that I'm bearing. I'm not denying it. I'm not, yeah, if it's too cold, I might put on a scarf, right? And go inside or seek medical attention. But in some cases, I'll throw that out there, take it or leave it. But also as an interesting practice I heard from him when he taught this curriculum last winter that I thought was valuable. I tried and I personally found it a valuable Kabbalah to like spend a little bit of time each day in the winter just like feeling the cold while walking from the car to the office or something. Just throw it out
there. So that's more like tolerance.
Interesting, right. So here, bearing or suffering, right? So we're rooting patience not in like overcoming discomfort in a certain sense, but in acknowledging it, which is already a little bit different, right? To acknowledge that certain things are not pleasant, not to pretend that they ought to be pleasant. Like, I should be a better person and not be bothered by this person. That's ultimately not exercising patience with ourselves or bearing our own discomfort. And that ultimately leads to like an angsty relationship with this mida. But I think, if I'm understanding correctly, part of the practice here is in being a little softer with how we deal with it as a more effective way of sort of accepting that it's okay for things not, you don't have to wish that you loved the flaw in your, I don't know, spouse or something, but if they have one, but rather to acknowledge that it exists, but to decide it's worth it to bear that discomfort, which is a different sort of practice.
I'm not sure if you understand that. You know, when it comes to the cold, you can want to change your mind this way, you know. but you know, when it comes to being patient with others, it's reasonable. Because sometimes you can communicate and say, you know, when that happens, bug me or whatever, can we talk about that? Things that are changeable. So it sounds like the things you can change, I feel like I necessarily want to sit back and say, don't worry about it. It should work. Change things I can't change. That I get, makes sense to then say, well, it wouldn't cold.
So I think you're hitting his point, if I'm hearing correctly, about like accepting injustice in a certain way. I mean, again, a stronger version of it, but could be if someone's not treating you correctly, right? That ultimately you actually ought to confront them because they're doing something wrong. And you should say, hey, look, that's not a nice way to treat me. Why are you doing that? I want to let you know that I'm not okay with that. The question, that's not in place of sablanut. Is the interesting thing here, right? In other words, while that thing is occurring in the relationship, one can bear the discomfort and still want to. It's a way of, instead of going to the person and saying, we're done being friends because you're mean to me, right? Like exiting the relationship, which sometimes might be called for. It's a different practice of sort of extending a little bit of, I'm going to bear this. I might still speak up and say, I wish I didn't have to bear this discomfort. Why are you doing this to me? But you're committed to being in relationship in a certain sense. Does that make sense? I think that's how he's working with it. So savlanut is still active in that case, even with rebuke, maybe. You might have forbearance and be rebuking someone forcefully for the way they're treating you, but you're still forbearing. You haven't lost it. You're in control.
When I think about your comment, Michael, what I think about is a couple that I am working with who have had a really hard load to bear, speaking of self-love, and I was coaching them in having a conversation with each other about a major disagreement they were having. And I had them facing each other, and literally almost everything they were saying
I was stopping, interrupting them and saying, why don't you say this instead? And of course, anybody I think could probably use this in their marriage at one time or another, or in any relationship. Like, I wish I had somebody who was in my house who could like re-script all the things that I say when I'm in a grumpy mood. But just, I feel like, at least for myself and in this couple, I saw this too, there's this tendency to, I'm angry. And so rather than continue to keep in mind that I love this person and I care for them and they don't always make me mad, I'm going to really lean into my anger and tell them all the things that they do wrong and you never, na 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 na, and you always, na 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 na. And also, I'm going to lean into that instead of leaning into like, oh, I feel hurt and ashamed and uncomfortable and just how hard it is. I don't know. It just made me think of how hard it is to your comment to hold on to all of those painful feelings and moments of being impinged upon by other people.
Mm. I think that kind of goes back to what Rabbi Dallinger said in the very, very beginning, is it's easier to kind of put it in context of other people or blaming other people than looking at yourself and accepting yourself and, you know, just stopping and having the patience to think, okay, maybe this is my fault or maybe I did do this versus trying to blame everybody else and just brush it off.
I don't know. For me, I struggle with this notion of bearing or suffering as a relationship with emotions. I find the best patience is when you're actually redirecting your attention to the positive things around you, and the lack of crisis or the lack of harm in whatever situation that's making you feel bad. Like, okay, I can take this. I can take this out. Just load it up on my back. There's other things I've got already up there. I don't know. Personally, I need patience. The best source of patience is taking my mind and letting those things go. Present with whatever is positive at the present time.
I don't know if I see it as like loading myself up with things, but I know that when I respond very quickly out of like anger or frustration or defensiveness, that I'm often not like my best self, or when I'm not like responding in a constructive way. So the way I see it is sort of, it's like taking that extra moment to think about what I actually need from that interaction, or, you know, to what Hannah was saying before, like the relation, what values I have in the relationship, and then responding. And it always ends up being better when I do it that way, as opposed to like saying something right away or doing something right away.
I've been doing that lately too, taking space. I'm not going to respond right away. I'll take as much space as I need. And when I'm ready, then I'll come back.
Exactly. I'm a slow processor. I like right. Tell people that. I'm like, I really need to like think about that for a second.
But why is it so hard in the moment to be like, what if I just waited 10 seconds? I'm so not a slow. Like, why does it feel so important to be like,
Is that like an ego thing, I wonder?
I don't know.
I mean, we all have it. We all feel it. I've definitely.
I feel like it's like a, like the,
because it's attack and defense.
Hmm.
I think there's a need to defend because you're attacked.
Right.
Hmm. Almost like physically. Yeah. Or yeah, there's this, I think, some sort of internal mechanism that pushes us to defend.
Hmm.
Because otherwise we feel like we're going to get destroyed. Get attacked.
Right.
Hmm. So this is where this would come in. To kind of remind ourselves, we're not getting attacked. I mean, we're not going to get killed. We can take 10 seconds. Mm-hmm. Think of it. Mm-hmm. Other stuff. Mm-hmm. But it feels like we're going to get good.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if, because of the, I feel like the things that Matt mean most impatient are not necessarily individual relationship issues, but it sounds like we're all thinking about patients with regard to a one-on-one relationship. I find myself, I'll say, much more impatient with things like the political process. Things like that. Things like that. Those are things when I feel impatient, it's not usually with the person, you know. And I think that when we think about that, then it's a different kind of question. It sounds like the question that we'd be asking ourselves in those things to me would be to say, I want a relationship with this person. So in a certain condition, certain circumstance, now, what do I need to do to maintain a relationship? So one's I'll be happy and humble, or another I'll be want to learn from them, or I'll be patient. But it's an answer to my relationships. It's sort of certain risks and hard time. What do I do to maintain it? And I'll apply one of these meters, you know, plug it in. But again, personally, I don't find that as much of a struggle with individual relationships of having to be. I don't know if that's the way in which we're speaking. I don't know whether other people
feel that. And I know my experience is usually that I'm not impatient with a particular thing, but there's a point at which I'm just too angry at too many things, and then whatever the last thing is, I get angry. But it's not like directed at a particular thing. It's just I'm mad now. I'm mad at anything, really. It doesn't matter what. It might have done nothing. So...
Mike, I wonder if maybe it's connected to the idea of powerlessness.
That's what I was thinking too. Like you're not in control of the political process.
Right. Like there's nothing you can do to change it.
Yeah. Right. It's hard because again, the cold. It's a good point because I feel like the cold. Again, I can very quickly intellectually tell myself that I'm really not in control of that. It feels like some things like you can work hard enough, but you could make a difference. Mm. And so some of those things, you give up the cold. But you give up to fill in the blank of things that you feel like if you worked hard enough, you really could change it. Mm. And then being patient is, and then I, it's because I think those are ones where I feel like I'm the most patient. Mm. It should be better. It could be better. Why is it?
Maybe the should is the part that gets you. It shouldn't be like this. And why is it like that?
Seems like just as with Anava, Sabranut should be the sweet spot between, you know, being able to carry some amount of emotional burden and, you know, recognizing not ready to carry too much, but it'll topple you over. I mean, you know, it doesn't seem like, you know, the ability to bear an endless amount of emotional discomfort is necessarily a good thing. There comes a point in which you need to be able to say, okay, enough is enough. I'm going to speak out. I'm not going to let, you know, I'm not going to let this person with whom I'm having a relationship, you know, take over my life, destroy me, whatever else. I had that circumstance, but it seems like I'm not seeing in the reading here the same conception of Sabalhud as being like in between, you know, how you're talking about Anava is like the sweet spot between arrogance and self-deprecation. But here it almost makes it seem like you can have an endless amount of emotional of ability to bear emotional discomfort.
I think it's about, and I'm just using my example, I think one of my biggest psychological issues is that I can be very efficient, which can be a good thing, but it can also rush me in decisions. In just making decisions, I want to check things off the list. So I'm always trying to do the right thing, but I'm, you know, trying to check things off the list. So for me, patience is about letting myself be okay with, you know, waiting a little bit before I decide if I'm going to go to something, you know, little things, bigger things, and sort of So for me, that baggage is, for me, that's uncomfortable because I feel like I just want to decide and get it done. So it's, for me, that weight, it's, and again, it's like the mindfulness piece of it is being okay with, for me, it's discomforting because I'm like, I want to check that off and just know what I've decided to do about what I'm going to do this weekend, whatever it is. And so for me, that baggage is just that uncomfortableness of, you know, but I think you have to have some sort of mindfulness to be, recognize that this is not great for me because I want to just move on to the next thing. But I think it leads to better decisions because I can tend to be rushed and trying to do too many things. So I don't know, that's how I conceive of like the sweet spot is it's like having an awareness of that discomfort. If that helps.
Maybe it's like making a decision between quantity versus quality.
Yeah.
How much you can check off versus
right.
It's valued.
Right. And sometimes when you make decisions, it does just take time, I think, to have it come to you. You know what I mean? Instead of just trying to rush it, you need to sometimes just sit back.
Being impulsive.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's really
cool. I have a question.
Yes.
The computer speaks.
The computer speaks. My association with patience and forbearance is thinking about how I get annoyed with my mom when she talks endlessly about people I don't know.
You have a mom like that too?
And if I indulge the annoyance, I speak sharply and try to stop the barrage of details. And she doesn't like this, of course. Now, my question is, if I do, as Rabbi Cordovero and we all are talking about, which is to remember the connection and soften to the annoyance that I feel. I mean, I've even said to her, what if I ask you to stop that more kindly? She said, yeah, that would be better. But even better is if you just like listen and be nicer just by not being so impatient to have things, you know, the conversation go the way you'd prefer is basically what this is about. So then the question is, can I be patient with that, which is to say, I've chosen to, if I choose to act out of love and just listen, which I do often enough, she just doesn't know it because she doesn't hear me say anything. then I get worried that there is no connection that's happening. She's talking about people I don't know, and I'm not really able to carry on that conversation because I don't know them. So I've prioritized love, but there isn't connection coming out of that conversation. So how can I not be annoyed about that? That's the question.
So there is a connection at her end to you.
Yeah.
She appreciates that.
That's true. So I can be in this sort of double consciousness of, I don't think that this is really about connection, but I'm prioritizing the connection so I know she's feeling it.
Does it have to be a kind of a connection that you want to have?
Right.
So for example, if my connection is with somebody, it's all about Lashon Hara, all the whole thing. But it's a connection. But so that's not a connection I want. And so despite the fact that that person wants it, I don't want it.
So what do you do?
Then we read the time. We learn about how do we distract and talk about the Yankees, whatever it is we're going to talk about. I don't know, but it feels like a different effort at that point. I don't feel like one should have to. I mean, it's like someone is insulting you, and you're just putting up with it because in this case, they're not seeing it as a harmful thing, but you're perceiving it, and I think if we think, let's say, Jewishly, we would say it is a harmful thing. Harmful for the person being talked about, harmful for us to listen, harmful for the person to talk about. It's just harm, harm, harm. And so even though the person says, yeah, but it's fun, or I like it, or I want to talk about it, no.
I think that's your example. I'm not sure if there's any Lashon Hara going here. It's just not interesting. It's just really boring. It's just not relevant, right, I think, is what she's saying.
Yeah, I mean, Lashon Hara, definitely there's another dimension.
But if you can try to understand what the purpose of it for her is and what the meaning is underneath it, and try to understand why is she talking about people you don't know, is it meaningful to her in some way? Mm-hmm. And even changing some of the questions that you may ask her about these people, why they're important to her, what it means to her to be with them, or you know, try to get underneath a little bit. You may find it one more interesting, but also understand where the behavior is coming from, the meaning behind it. And it might help you be more patient with it.
Yeah, I think it's generally a question of sharing what's in the mind.
So that's valuable in and of itself.
The people that are important to her, she's sharing with you.
Sharing what's in the mind as it moves.
I wanted to thank you for bringing that example to the fore. There were many nods around the table as you gave the example. And so I'm going to gather from the knowing nods and looks of affection you can't see that many people are responding to this because it is a common...
I'm really aggravated right now.
We're all like, I'm not a world. I'm thinking about two people.
We're like right back in that conversation. Right? Mm-hmm.
Over and over again. And it can be very difficult. You know, if you go in with a different mindset of expecting that, and yes, you know, and you respond and you have a way to respond, they're not doing anything on purpose, but yet it can be very active.
So I'll make it personal for a little bit. I'm like an introvert, and so I hate large, relatively shallow conversations. And then I started this job, and Kiddush was killing me. It was the end of me. Every week I was going around, oh, how are you? I'm good. How are you? Good. Oh, wait. Hi. How are you? And it was just like an hour of like, why did that hour happen? And and so I asked a rabbi and social worker, who's both who I know, like, how can I survive Kiddush? And he said, you need to reframe. Why are people telling you things that you don't care about? And this is risky, and trying to encourage vulnerability. And I said, well, I think they want me, even though I don't know them so well yet, I had just started this job, to like, they want a relationship. And so they want to share intimate details about people I don't know about, and I barely know them yet. And so he said, so during Kiddush, the challenge is you should try and form a relationship with people. So that was hard, but it was helpful. Mm. For me, it took it out of like, this is annoying to me. And it's like, okay, you do things that are annoying to other people. Like, this is a two-way street here. So I think that's the advice I got, which is a little bit like, suck it up. But
I mean, when I think about places in my life where I have been able to attain, I think, real self-love, like I'm thinking of a relative that we have who is quite disabled cognitively and has dementia. And I think that part of it is just really getting to a place where I don't expect or hope it to be different, which isn't the same as just taking it on endlessly because right. they want me to. It's just like, oh, this is how it is. So I'm going to maintain awareness of my own needs and maintain awareness of the balance of when can I actually deal with this, because it's not going to change and this is what's there in the relationship. And when am I going to say, oh, I'm actually really exhausted, so I'm going to go take a nap or whatever. So maybe that, Vicky, what you said about Savlanut being the sweet spot was really helpful to me, but it's not about bearing and bearing and bearing and bearing without sort of checking in with oneself. It's just having that extra mindfulness to be aware of what's really going on here. How can I accept this as it is and then respond versus react?
I'm uncomfortable with the first sentence. Why does it have to be emotional discomfort for the patient? It can be, but it doesn't have to be. You mean, use the whole, again, understanding things, the process, and being patient just means you can't get what you want when you want it all the time. That's not a bad thing.
That's uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be uncomfortable. If you know that's the way it is, you may not like it, but you can learn to sort of.
But then it becomes what you want. If you accept that it's coming, then it's not something that you don't want. You kind of accept it as what you want. But if it's still in the phase that you don't want, then it's uncomfortable.
A good parent would teach their child to learn patience by bearing discomfort.
Like not all, I don't think all patients have to be
right. No, it does.
Right.
But that's how he defines it. But even the word is to bear or to suffer.
I'm with you on that.
The Torah, who would like to read? I'll just read a little more of this. Actually, this is helpful. I hope this is helpful to me. Thank everyone for sharing. Many personal examples have come out in this conversation. I'm grateful.
Somebody else from me. All right. The Torah calls Moses the most humble man on earth. Rashi, the 11th century Torah commentator, understands the word humble to mean that Moses is a savla, an extremely forbearing person. This is a bit odd because Moses seems to struggle with anger throughout his leadership. He murders an abusive Egyptian taskmaster, smashes the tablets upon seeing the golden calf, and strikes the rock to get water, defying God's instruction to speak to the rock. How can Rashi describe Moses as a savlan? Keep going.
Sure.
Moses's savlanut is his capacity to stay connected to others even as he experiences strong and challenging emotions. One of the refreshing things about the Torah is its honest, if at times unflattering, portrayals of its main characters, including God. Life is messy, as are the relationships in the Torah. Moses merits the title of a savlan because he stays with the Israelites for the long haul, carrying the load of their stubbornness, complaining, and rebelliousness, even when God is ready to give up on them. In one poignant scene after the golden calf incident, God tells Moses, "Behold, they are a stiff-necked people. Now leave me alone so that my anger may blaze forth against them." Moses refuses to leave God alone at this moment. Rather, he implies, "God, do not let your anger blaze forth against your people. Turn from your blazing anger. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." Not only does Moses refuse to leave God alone to rage in anger, he reminds God of God's connection to the people. The intervention succeeds, and the people go on to receive the second set of tablets. This refusal to cast off the burden of his people typifies Moses' leadership.
We'll read one more paragraph, maybe.
The only time Moses truly despairs of the people, he requests assistance from God, saying that the burden is too heavy for him to bear. God instructs Moses to choose 70 elders who will become assistant prophets and share the load of leadership. This is another key teaching about Savlanut. When we feel at the end of our ability to bear something, it may be time for us to request help from others.
Ooh.
because it doesn't tell us that we have to do everything alone. That it's okay to ask for help.
I think also maybe the nature of, I don't know if impatience is the right word, is that it feels isolating, like you get caught up in yourself at that moment. And so to ask for help, like to bring in others and say, it is like counterintuitive when you're, for me, when I'm experiencing fed up, I'm done with it, whatever, saying to someone like, I'm really fed up with life, can you just walk me off the ledge here, is not the natural reaction at that moment. The natural reaction is to indulge oneself in a certain sense, or for me, to indulge myself. So this kind of like reminds us also that we can, that there are, we all have friends and supportive people that want to help us. I think everyone here, I hope, does. Maybe that's harder at times, actually. But even just the idea of turning outside is actually challenging in that moment, but profoundly helpful.
I think that also speaks to those bigger picture things that one person can't necessarily solve themselves, that you have to sort of coordinate with other people in order to fix something that you can no longer have patience for.
Mm-hmm. It can also kind of be humbling to realize that you then need to ask for help. Mm-hmm. That you can't do it alone. You can't do everything alone. I don't think anybody can do everything alone.
I don't know why I'm feeling totally skeptical about this today. The description they just gave is like, patience is like, sometimes you blow up at people, and sometimes you stick with it, and sometimes you ask for help, and it's like, you just like do all like the human things that you do, and you stick with it, and that's patience.
But I think there's also figuring out if you do blow up, it's to figure out why. Well, what chord did that strike? What button was pressed? And what did that mean to you? And to understand yourself better. So that's part of it. So you can then do the next time, not the same thing, or deal with other issues.
Plus, I think it depends on what kind of relationship it is, too, right? There's like so many relationships in your life. I mean, I recently offloaded on half the people in this room because of like an issue in my life. And it was just because like it was so overbearing on me that I was like, I know the people that I can trust. And I like, you know, was able to, you know, discuss it. But if it was a different situation, like I wouldn't feel the same situation like if it was, you know, maybe me and my sister or me, or like whatever, like, you know, you find people that can, that you just feel that you can relate to, and they'll understand. I don't know. It all depends on what the situation is. It's not across the board, I think.
Not black and white.
Right.
Yeah, I get it. But I guess that's a weird lesson. Is like, well, it's going to look differently all the time. Sometimes you'll do this, and sometimes you'll do this. And it's kind of like, right. That's like, okay, so that's life. It's just life. Yeah, I don't understand what that, like, what the patience piece is.
Yeah. Isn't the common thread in all of them that you become more aware of your reaction, whatever it is, needs to be, I think, sometimes slower, sometimes faster, sometimes whatever is more appropriate.
Self-aware.
Less appropriate.
Yeah. Yes. Self-aware.
Yeah.
I understand that as like something that we value, but out of the lesson, that's not what Moses is display, at least from right. What I'm reading of the like,
right.
So that's the part, right? Like, yeah, I agree. Self awareness is an important part of patience. I don't understand where
this.
Yeah, I don't know
how. I don't know
why Moses
called
this
Sublime. Actually, I don't know what's Sublime about him.
Well, I'm gonna just defend Moses for a moment.
it's a worthy task.
Goes on that note. You know, imagine for the moment in the narrative that God comes to you and says, like, I don't know, I'll give a hypothetical. Imagine that you're sick of your job, your boss is out of control, the coworkers don't pull their weight, you're doing everything for everyone and they get paid. And And God comes to you and says, I'm just blow this office up tomorrow because, you know, you're the only nice person here. The rest of these people is just horrible. I'm going to have an office space style scene and just destroy the office and remove you to get a new job. And you say, actually, no, you know, if you could give the people in the office here another chance. So I think Moses' patience is like the Israelites are legitimately frustrating in the Torah. They're like really ungrateful.
Well, that's not patience, though. He's asking Hashem not to be rash. He's asking God not to be impatient. I mean, I'm not sure if he's being impatient. He's saying, you're being impatient, God. You're rushing into this. Take a look. It's worthy. There's enough good things going on. Give us another chance. Give them another chance.
It's all about maintaining the connection. Regardless of how you approach it, the underlying thing is you want to maintain the connection of whatever's causing the issue, right? So if you're looking to disassociate with anyone in this.
Yeah. Because I don't think Moses ever says to God, like, actually, like, the Israelites are really good farmers, and they make really nice calves. Like, he doesn't say
that. He says, God, you're going to regret this.
He says you're going to regret this, but not because, like, they're so awesome. It's just like,
But
exactly. He doesn't say they have the potential. Does he say they have the potential?
Well, he implies.
I feel like he says,
actually, people are going to question you and say, you took them out of Egypt. And then look at you, you're a pretty pathetic god, essentially, because they died in the desert. That's the Torah saying to me, Bli Yecholet Hashem, God couldn't do it. He couldn't get
God of God's connection to the people.
Maybe it's like the Sablanut part. Yeah, now I'm coming over to Brandon. I feel like the bearing, the ways, like, meh. But maybe it's more like being willing to get back on the horse again. Like, okay, I screwed up. I'm going right back in again. Like, I'm not going to burn this whole thing down. You know what I mean?
That's interesting. That's a little.
But just stick to it.
Stick to it. And not giving up.
Yeah.
Persevering.
Yeah. But so I think forbearance and perseverance are related, as are humility and forbearance. And part of the interesting things about looking at all of these character attributes in collective is they begin to meld and bleed into each other. To the point of being unable to discuss them cogently. So on that note, I do want to say I really appreciate that people, I think, took the cue and really began to internalize and work with. I have a feeling people are doing that in the chavrutas, for those that are able to do that or studying the material. And that's, I think, the real benefit from this is to beginning to look critically, is maybe too strong, at our own lives or at the texts, either way, but to really grapple with the material. And maybe I'll give people like a minute now if you want to think about a Kabbalah or focus phrase that you might. There's some suggestions on 79. I've said, love the suggestions for me, but you might for you.
I have a question about one of the phrases I found in the mystical paragraph on page 75.
Yeah.
There's a phrase that comes up a couple of times about divine abundance, which seems like a useful trait. And I wonder what the Hebrew is for that. Thinking it might be enough.
Yeah, look at there.
The shuffle,
Shefa there. Shefa, flow.
Well, it says the flow of divine abundance. So
I don't know. In Hebrew, it just says shofea shefa, the flow of flow in the Hebrew.
Oh, that's kind of nice, actually. Shofea shefa.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's also shefa.
Or in English, go with the flow.
Okay. What are we talking about? Where are we? Kabbalah.
Just one note about the suggested Kabbalah. One of them, Noseh Ba'oli Mechabero, that one should share the burden with one's fellow. In context, that's not about your own burden, but about your fellow's burden. Mm-hmm. It's a proactive practice of empathy, actually. Mm-hmm. Here, the way it's listed, mm-hmm. It kind of could be either. It could be share your burden with your fellow. But in context, what it means to say is, you notice a burden of your neighbor. What is it like to do that? And so it's interesting to think about the reason I want to highlight that, maybe this will be the final note, is to the extent that we might be soliciting communal or other help outside in sort of dealing with burdens, to what extent are we players in other people's burdens, either creating them or alleviating them? Because that is also part of this. It's not just an internal practice. Know that. All right. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
I am getting sick.